thank you, John and Jeremy and the other organizers for organizing and putting together this marvelous workshop. It's terrific. And I was thinking, I don't really have I just have a tiny story about Stu. In 1995, I was at this theoretical chemistry meeting, and I'm walking down to the hotel, I think, and along comes a Jeep, stops, and it's Stu. I come and climb in, I climb in, and I say, oh, I have a Jeep just like this. And cool, and you know, we're talking, and I don't know how it came up, but the second car, well, I have an aging, you know, almost 20-year-old Chevette. Oh, well, so do I. You must be kidding. And, you know, so, yeah, I think we're the only two people on Earth with that combination, and certainly the only two that were proud of it. And I was thinking, when did I meet Ray? And I can't remember. it's like in mid-80s sometime. And we've had a lot of fun together. And mainly, you know, it's usually wine and food and discussions. And I greatly appreciate Ray's science. And I am very appreciative of him in our discussions because he's always extremely generous with his scientific ideas. And so one of our meetings, here we go. One of our meetings was a couple of years ago in Trieste, and I organized a meeting, and I was happy that Ray could come. Came on the weekend with Maureen for the second week, and I was complaining about our first week's Wednesday reception, because it had very bad pizza, even by American standards, and pretty bad wine as well. And where Ray Caprell is, there is usually good wine. And so we decided to try to have a wine party the second week. And so I talked with the secretary, and she said, and the bad pizza and wine cost us almost 1,000 euros. I said, how about letting us spend, you know, something less and have a wine and cheese party? She said, fine. And so Ray and mine had a smart car. Fortunately, it was a two-door. And we went, we went to Udine, and Maureen, I think, reserved us a lunch in a very nice country cafe. And Ray was on a mission to find Picolet and this wonderful dessert wine. And he asked the proprietor to recommend a place. And she said, well, this is the place we buy all our wine. So we went up to, went to this vineyard, and we actually had to call the guy in from his vineyard, and he came in, and Patrick De Kepper was there, Ray, Maureen, and myself, and we had a wonderful tasting. And Ray was driving, so he was very careful, you know, to spit. Patrick and I were not so careful, and I was less careful than Patrick, and, you know, got basically wasted. And in the middle of the afternoon, and but we had a great time. And we each bought. I had to give my receipt to ICTP, but it was 650 or so euros of Rufosco and Pinot Grigio, and this is what I bought from my personal stash. I think Ray's was much bigger because he had the Picolet and a lot of other things. And so we had our wine party on Wednesday, and it was a great success. So we were all very grateful for Ray's expertise again at that time. So we had a great, it's just one of all the great times we've had together. So today I'd like to tell you about some work that we've been doing on networks of excitable nodes. The people who did all the work are Mark Tinsley and Aaron. He's a senior postdoc with me, and Aaron Steele is a physics graduate student. And I need to thank NSF, ONR, and the Keck Foundation for making it all possible. We do experiments, and any simulations, it's all motivated by the experiments. And we use this photosensitive Belousov-Jabotinsky reaction, in which we are able to adjust the excitability with light. And, you know, without going into the chemistry, it turns out that the catalyst, this ruthenium complex, with light generates an inhibitor to autocatalysis in this system. So the brighter the light, the less active the system. You use a video projector, and we do this quite a bit in other contexts, change the optics and get a little screen, you know, a centimeter by centimeter or something like that. And, you know, you monitor it and try to correct for all the inhomogeneities, et cetera. You flow catalyst-free reaction mixture across this gel containing this catalyst. And so we set it up in the following way. And I want to make sure that everyone gets this, because everything follows from this. We image this gel with a camera, and then we assign a grid onto this image, you know, in the computer. And then we assign links from one random node or cell to another random node or cell. We prepare the system so that it's oscillatory in the dark, and then we increase the homogeneous light intensity until it's in a excitable stationary state. Okay? And so the way that the experiment works is we start it by initiating a wave in the middle of the domain, and when it propagates out to what we call a source node, this is a source node, this is a destination node, when it propagates out, we have some threshold, and we arbitrarily say 50%, we say that this link is active, and we initiate a wave at the destination node by making that cell dark. And since it's dark, it's oscillatory, and so a wave is initiated, and you see it right there. Okay, the next one it hits is right here, the destination or source node, and here's the destination node. And so that's the way the whole thing works. It's very simple. And please interrupt me if you have any questions on this as well. Okay, so you can look at this static network structure. You know, you can look at the mean path lengths, and with zero, when I talk about links, these are these non-diffusive links that I just described. With zero links, this just reflects the mean path length, just reflects the regular lattice. Okay, and then as you add links, you go further and further toward a random graph. And so, you know, somewhere in between, you have kind of a small world character. I forgot to mention that you also have this clustering coefficient is another diagnostic, which is not very sensitive to the number of links. This is basically the number of links between neighbors of an individual node normalized by the number of possible links. But you know, you can see that you go to the characteristics of the random graph with just not that many links going this direction. So that's pretty standard stuff. Here's the kind of behavior you see. These are simulations with a model of the Belousov-Jabotinsky reaction. This shows a time sequence of the plot we just looked at with these 10 links. There was the first one. There was the second one. And if we look at the movie, you can see kind of how this looks. With a few number of links. If we increase the number of links, I guess I should have mentioned this. Grid. We have a 1,000 by 1,000 grid, and each of the cells are 20 by 20, so we have 2,500 cells to make up this domain. And then with 100 links, you start getting much more coherent behavior. And then you go up to 500 links, and you can see in the snapshots that we're going to see much more coherent type behavior. Here are the links of the systems that I just showed you. This is the first one we've already talked about. This is 100, and this is 500. We also do experiments. Everything's experiment-oriented. And you can see these destination nodes. Now, you know, it's much smaller. It's 260 by 260 with 10 by 10 cells, or 676 cells that we have in this grid. And you can see these are the destination nodes or cells where they turn black to initiate a wave. Now, the thing that makes this interesting, at least in my mind, is that not all of the links are active, because if a destination node is in a refractory zone or excited, it's not going to initiate a new wave. And so the dynamics of the system feeds back on the network. And so here is the experimental system. Maybe I can turn down these lights a little bit. And here we see this is the simulations with, I guess, the simulations. This is 200 in red, 200 non-local links, and 10 in blue. So you get a higher amplitude, and this really comes from a phase synchronization. The amplitude is related to that. And then in the experiments, I guess we have 300 links in red and 20 in blue for this system. I should tell you what I'm plotting here. We talk about fractional coverage. This is basically, you know, you set a threshold and you count up all the pixels above that threshold to indicate the fraction of the medium that's in the excited state. And it's just one measure, a way to try to figure out what's going on. You can also think about the time it takes for an excitation to move through this network. And we set the dark color to be early time and light color to be late time. And you can see these, where these links go out and initiate new sites. And then the light zones are where you have collisions. And you can also not only talk about the transit time, how long does it take, but or the distance, how far is it? And if you assign all your local links weight as 1, and then you have these non-local links, non-diffusive jumps, give them some weight, W, and we define this as the time it takes to initiate a non-local excitation normalized by the time it takes for a local initiation. You can see if you went on the local grid, it would be 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, but if you went from A to B with the jump, it'd be 1, plus W plus 1 is 2 plus W, so you can get there faster because W is typically less than unity. And so you can look at, these are our simulations, you can look at this time of travel using some algorithm, and typically Dijkstra's algorithm is the one to use, and you can look at this distance and compare it with the plot we just saw for transit time. And the only thing that this shows the shortest distance through the network, according to Dijkstra's algorithm. And it doesn't have any information about the chemistry other than W. And so it's basically saying that, let me just show you. This is the experiments, and we just have 10 links, so it's not so elaborate, but if you think about what this is saying, it's saying that the wave finds the shortest distance through the network, which is not surprising, but it's interesting. You can also look at frequency synchronization, and here we plot out of the 2,500 nodes, we plot 25 nodes, the instantaneous period, and you can see they all settle down to a common period with 30 lengths and also with 180 lengths. And if we look at the standard deviation of all the periods, you can see that it settles down also we add another one here at 120, which kind of comes back alive but then settles down to a common frequency. Now the reason that you get a frequency synchronization in this system is because you have what we call network pacemakers. And the way a network pacemaker works is if a wave runs into a source node and sends the excitation behind the wave to a destination node, then you have a loop, and that's a pacemaker. And so if you have very few links, then this node may remain in the excitable state for a while, and the time it takes to go from the destination node to a source node plus the time it takes to excite the source node. And also, it's highly dependent upon the network structure, so you get a big standard deviation. But as you go to more and more links, pretty soon you reach the point where the source node is excited as soon as it can be, as soon as it relaxes enough to be excited. And this is basically the excitation cycle, which is, you know, more or less like the time of the limit cycle if you were to go a little bit into the oscillatory state. And so you reach this plateau. These loop structures can be quite complicated and have many go through circuitous routes. You can also talk about the phase synchronization of the nodes, and not surprisingly, as you add more and more links, you go to a higher degree of phase synchronization. At 0R, you would expect the phases to be equally distributed. At R equals 1, they would all be in phase. And we know that when this system is completely in phase, that's pathological because there's only one stable state, and that's the stable excitable stationary state. And so if it's all in phase, it will collapse. And so so we'd never expect it to be, we never expect to see R approach 1 in this system. Well, one of the things I think we learned from this study is that, and I alluded to it before, that not all the links are active. In fact, a lot of them are inactive. And if you plot here the number of links as a function of the number of active links, and we define this active link as a link that initiated a wave, you see that only about a third of the links are active, and two-thirds are inactive. And so the system basically has, you know, a way of sorting out which links are going to be responsible for the dynamics that you observe. Another way to kind of get at what's going on is to look at each of these links, and basically what we're doing is we're plotting the destination nodes, and we arbitrarily plot them from the center out, and you get, Antonio was showing us earlier, a raster type plot, and then it starts over again, and as each node fires. But then we wanted to ask what is the stability of this sequence of active links. And so what we do is we remove link 6, which is this one right here. We remove it at 24.4, and we put it back at 40 and see what happens. And you can see here that the structure changed from this sequence to this sequence. And so that sequence, that perturbation, it was not stable to that perturbation, that this active node sequence or link sequence. On the other hand, if you remove link 4, which I think is this one, and put it back at 40, you get back the same sequence. So this is just kind of a first attempt to look at stability of these sequences. I'm sorry? This is simulation. Yeah, I'm going to show you a second an experiment. These are asymptotic states. Let me just focus on this system here where we changed from one sequence to one pattern to another. I want to show you a before and after. Here are the nodes before. We removed this link to this node 6. And what happened was we lost number 4, which I think is interesting because 4 didn't affect anything earlier, and we gain five new nodes, 15 through 19. And so this is the network active structure after. This is before. The experiments Leon just asked about, everything I've talked about is kind of the asymptotic behavior of simulations on this active link sequence. But here we look at the transient behavior of the active link sequence in an experiment, and eventually the system stabilizes to this sequence. These two are repeated. And you can see that the system actually has this kind of self-pruning mechanism that it starts off with a variety of active links, but then some of those become inactive. And so now let's return to this slide I showed at the very beginning of the minimum path length. These blue circles are the circles of the active links. Not just all, these are all the links, this red line. And you can see that it scales the same, but remember that only about a third of the links are active. And so what it means is that your dynamics at 150 is with actually a much lower mean path length is given the dynamics you see occur with the active links at 50. And so I think this is kind of interesting, that it's kind of an optimization of some sort. We've also looked at these are all static networks that I've described. We can do the same kind of thing with what we call a dynamic network. And now when a wave moves into a cell, instead of that being a source cell and going to a destination cell, we flip a coin. There's a probability that there will be a jump, and the jump can go anywhere to some random destination cell. And the dynamics don't look that different. This is with low jump probability, but as you go to I'm getting ahead of myself. With low jump probability, you see rather it's not very periodic at all. Here's the power spectrum, but as you increase the jump probability, it starts to show periodicity. But this definitely has much more stochasticity in it, even though it looks similar. Here are experiments with this dynamic link network. Again, it's the same setup with 676 cells. Here are the time series with a low jump probability. We have this dotted line with the high jump probability. We have this periodic looking behavior. We went one step further and thought, it could be, in real networks, say a neuronal network, you're not going to have just a random placement. Maybe there are regions that would be more favorable for length than others. Then you can also think in this in terms of population biology, of cities having links. And so we developed what we call the domain network, the domain model, and this is exactly the same as the dynamic model, the dynamic link model, except with the only exception is that all links must go, they cannot go to themselves, they must go to another domain. And so it has some interesting features. We made our domains kind of fit Zipf's law, and then links from a domain are proportional to the domain size. So this city, I guess, is a population of 2,600 cells, and so the departure rate can be ascertained just from the graphics, basically. And links to a domain for very large populations are also proportional to the size. Here is a with low jump probability. Oops, wrong thing. Okay, right. I'm going to show you a couple of movies with this is low jump probability. We don't see much coherent behavior at all. At higher jump probability, we start to see something that looks a little bit like synchrony. And then at higher jump probability, we start to see a lot more synchrony. And here are plots of what we just saw. This was the first one, not much periodicity, a little bit more, and then finally a lot more. The thing that we found interesting in this higher jump probability is that the system collapses. And I will show you the tail end of that movie, and you can see the collapse. And it's for exactly the same reason I mentioned earlier. Once the system is in synchrony, then I'll do it again. Once it's synchronized, then it has to collapse. But it doesn't have to be completely synchronized. You know, this is the last dot, and as long as that domain could not excite any of the other domains because they were all in the refractory state, so you have it collapses, and so you have a region of in which the collapse occurs. Okay, I'll quickly show you some experiments. This is at low jump probability, and we don't see much synchrony, but at higher jump probability, we see quite a lot. And then I'll show you the time series. Time series, this is the last one we saw, this is the first one we saw, and this middle one, we didn't see the green one. The one thing we don't see in the experiments, we have never seen this collapse, and my feeling is it's just because our experiments aren't homogeneous enough. You know, I think that the inhomogeneity keeps the system alive, basically. And if it's homogeneous, like in a simulation, it will collapse. But in an experiment, you know, you've got your gel, you've got the edges of your gel, all this stuff that can cause inhomogeneity. Well, we, more recently have been trying to think about how we can make this more realistic. And so, you know, first thing, if you look through the literature, things are not even uniformly distributed with random connections. You know, there's often the neurophysiology literature, they'll talk about some fall off, and oftentimes they will talk about exponential fall off for length. You know, you're linked to neurons that are closer and less as you it falls off as you move away. And also, it's quite straightforward to think about incorporating an integrate and fire model into this system, because all we have to do is, we have the system at some illumination, and we have, say, 10 links coming into a node. Each time a link is active, then it lowers the illumination intensity by some amount. And so you keep lowering and sum it up until you reach a threshold, and then it fires. And you can also put in inhibitory links that go the other way. And so we do that. Typically, we just kind of pick a number that seems to be around in the literature of about 20% inhibitory length. And so this is how we implement this, just with the light intensity. And so this is a network without any diffusive coupling. And here, this has 1,600 nodes with 125,000 lengths, and 80 are excitatory with a weight of 0.03, and 80%, and 20% are inhibitory with a weight of 0.-0.08. And you can kind of see, even without any diffusion, there's kind of interesting patterns that go on in this network. I think there's about 62.5 links per node that are excitatory and 15 and a half or so that are inhibitory. Here is the network with diffusion. And we're doing experiments now, but these are simulations. And so you can see with diffusion, I think it's even nicer. You start getting these kind of targets spreading through the network. We have fewer links now, 42,000 links, because we have a lot of links due to the diffusive coupling that just occur naturally. Now we want to go one step further and try to, incorporate some kind of spike timing dependent plasticity. And the idea is that, if you have a presynaptic potential that fires before the postsynaptic potential fires, then there's causality. And so you would think that there should be a Hebbian strengthening, a Hebbian learning increase, positive Hebbian learning. But on the other hand, if the synaptic potential fires after, then you would think that there is no causality, and so there should be a negative Hebbian learning. And we went to this paper by Rosen et al., who have this model of a stable weight distribution, which seems to be a big problem with spike timing dependent plasticity. But this one is a stable distribution, and so we can implement this on our system. And I'm almost finished here. And it's simply, we just monitor the state of the source cell and the target cell, and increment our excitatory lengths, either negative or positive, depending upon this timing difference. Don't confuse this with inhibitory lengths. This is only for excitatory lengths. It's easy to get confused by this. But here is the weight distribution due to this spike timing dependent plasticity, this STDP. You can see it went from about 0.3, and it'll increase up to about 0.6. And we also have 20% inhibitory lengths here that we don't show because they don't undergo this Hebbian plasticity. And then this is the last thing I'll show is this is kind of a histogram of all the nodes with a particular weight. So we add up all the nodes with a particular weight and it's the same experiment we just saw. Due to this STDP model, going from 0.03 to 0.06 of weight, it shifts the entire histogram up. So hopefully next time we see each other, I'll be able to tell you about experiments, and I'll let you read the summary. Thank you very much.